Rachel Schofield. Welcome to the Bokomi podcast, bringing you new books full of Omi. Yes, we are all about original, memorable insights, and we turn to the smartest minds in business, science, tech, and culture to find them. In today's episode, we're meeting one half of a duo who believe humor is the most under-leveraged tool for power in the working world.
Hi, I'm Naomi Bagdonis, author of Humor Seriously, Why Humor is a Superpower at Life and in Work. And this is my Omi for Book Omi.
Naomi is a Stanford lecturer, a strategy and media consultant, and a professionally trained comedian. With behavioral psychologist Dr. Jennifer Archer, she runs one of the most oversubscribed courses amongst Stanford MBA students, and their book, Humor Seriously, is the result.
There are few things that impact our brain and our psychology like laughter. So when we laugh, our brains release a cocktail of hormones that do all these different things to us. And so when we hold things so tightly at work, when we are taking ourselves so seriously and our missions so seriously without having the outlet of laughter and humor, then we bring that home as well. And all of a sudden, and we find this in the data, all of a sudden we're not laughing as much at home. And we're not laughing as much with our partner, and we're having a harder time finding joy.
Their research shows that being funny at work isn't unprofessional, but can actually enhance our influence and status, build bonds and diffuse tension within teams, enhance creativity and problem solving, and even make us more likable. So, should you dust off your old joke books and invest in an office whoopee cushion? Not quite. It is, of course, a whole lot more subtle than that. And I'm delighted that Naomi is here to tell us more. Naomi Bagdonis, welcome to Bokomi.
Thank you, Rachel. Thank you so much for having me.
And of course, we should say that you're very clear right at the start of the book that although it's all about humor, the difference is it's about humor. It's not about jokes in the workplace. Tell us the premise of all of this.
Yeah, that's right. So one of the big insights that we had in our process of writing this book was the realization that humor is a mindset. It's not so much an act as we think it is. So we think of humor as writing jokes and getting the perfect punchline. And of course, there are aspects of that. And we have a whole chapter in the book that'll help you do just that. But more importantly, it is fundamentally navigating the world in a different way, on the precipice of a smile rather than a frown. And so that's really what we're trying to teach people to do through this work.
Yeah, and the book is such a cracking read. I mean, I must admit, this thing about a mindset change and almost like a behavioral cultural change in a subtle way got to the point where I kind of halfway through reading it, I took a break and I went into the kitchen and I sort of dived through the door with kind of jazz hands, and my teenage kids looked at me like I'd gone utterly mad. But I did feel, just reading it made me feel sort of uplifted and fun, and not in a silly way, but just it kind of shifted my outlook even just while I was reading that one chapter. And I'm guessing you're saying to people, think again about the way you behave and are perceived at work.
That's exactly right. And I love the idea that people reading our book are just creating madness all over the world, like you, just going
small moments of madness
in the kitchen with jazz hands. That's completely beautiful. But yeah, that's exactly right. And you know, our students at Stanford, they come in on the first day of class pretty nervous and you know, uncertain what they're there to learn. They think that they're there to learn stand-up comedy. And in fact, the first insight is just how little humor we have in our lives. And so there's an incredible wealth of data to suggest that we adults have fallen off a humor cliff. And, you know, this is a data set of 1.4 million people across 166 countries. What it shows is that around age 23, we fall off this cliff where we stop laughing as much, we stop thinking that we're funny. And this decline continues until we are about 70. So really, it is our entire working professional lives when we aren't laughing as much and we aren't believing ourselves to be humorous people. And of course, if you think of humor as sort of a fun, frivolous thing, then you think, okay, well, that's fine. It just doesn't belong in the workplace. But in fact, as you said earlier, we really believe that humor is a secret weapon in the workplace. It's under leverage. It's people don't think of it that way, but it's really incredibly powerful.
Yeah, there was the quote in the book where you said humor has a profound impact on human behavior and psychology and can even give people a competitive advantage in business. Tell us more about some of the, because you've gone deep dive on this. You've looked at the sort of biology, the neuroscience, the practicalities of humor, and it's thrown up some really interesting stuff.
The brain science is profound when you look at laughter. There are few things that impact our brain and our psychology like laughter. So when we laugh, our brains release a cocktail of hormones that do all these different things to us. So they release dopamine, which makes us happier and also increases our retention, our memory retention. Oxytocin, which makes us trust people more. It lowers our cortisol and epinephrine. So this is, you can think of this as sort of our fight or flight stress hormones. So it makes us more relaxed. It opens our minds. It's this incredible cocktail that, as you said, makes us be perceived as more confident and powerful by other people, primes our brains for meaningful social connection with people, makes us more creative, and importantly for times like these, makes us more resilient to the stressors of our lives. I'll give one example of this. We know that when strangers meet each other, if you put two strangers in a room and you ask them to have a conversation about themselves, just share a little bit about yourself. If we have those two strangers watch a comedy clip and laugh a little bit before they have that conversation versus two strangers who just go in the room and start talking to each other, we know that that first pair of strangers who laugh together will disclose significantly more personal information to each other. Their conversations will be viewed as by others as more intimate, and they'll feel closer. So this is incredible, right? Just two strangers feeling closer and having more intimate conversations simply because they laugh together, and therefore they primed their brains for more meaningful social connection.
And I guess what you are saying in the book then is that if you extrapolate from that, which is just two strangers in maybe a social scenario, if you take some of the juiciness from that and put it into an office environment, into a business that's trying to do something dynamic and powerful and meaningful and effective, then this could really make a big difference.
Absolutely. We know that we are in the midst of an incredible trust deficit in our world right now. And this shows up in our political systems. This shows up in our businesses. There was a recent survey published by Harvard Business Review that found 58% of employees would rather trust a complete stranger than their own boss, which is really incredibly sad. And at the same time, we know that bosses and managers who are seen as having a sense of humor, by the way, not funny, just that they have a sense of humor, they can appreciate humor, are viewed by their by folks in their organizations as more trustworthy, as more motivating, and as more effective. And these are big numbers. These are, 23% more respected, 27% more motivating. These are significant impacts on people's perceptions of us just because we're able to use some humor. This is partly about making people laugh because, as we talked about, it impacts our psychology. It's also about simply bringing more humanity into our workplaces. We talk in the book about how we fundamentally need a new type of leader in today's world. It used to be that leaders needed to be revered, right? They were sort of this rare breed of person who was perfect, really, and who was above everyone else, sequestered in their CEO offices and rarely seen by their employees. And now, with all of the behind-the-scenes access that we have to, big, important people, with with social media, with all of the mistrust that we have really in our world, people crave something fundamentally different from our leaders. And that is humanity, that's being real, it's vulnerability. And in that context, humor is a really powerful window into those things.
And yet you make the point very powerfully in the book that for a lot of people who are leaders, they would be nervous of using any kind of humor because they think maybe it makes them less serious.
Right, absolutely. So this is one of the four before deadly humor myths, as we outline them in the book. And one of those is called the serious business myth. And it's the myth that, you know, humor simply has no place amid serious work. And this is, of course, something that we debunk with lots of research, lots of data, and of course, stories from leaders.
People's instinct would be, if I am too humorous, I don't want to say silly, but if I let the veneer slip, then somehow I lose authority.
Right. And of course, there's a balance that we don't want people making jokes all the time, but the bar is so low in business these days. And we also find people have some misperceptions about what humor looks like in the workplace. So this is another one of our myths that, you know, humor equals comedy. And actually, it's really not. It's more about just having some lightheartedness and levity. So I'll give one example. Hiroki Asai was the head of marketing communications for Apple for many years, alongside Steve Jobs. And he led a group of 2,000 creatives. And his rationale for the importance of humor was, fear is the greatest killer of creativity, and humor is the best insulator that he has found for fear. So if he can create a culture of levity and of humor, then he can really insulate his culture and have creativity flourish. Well, Hiroki was not, you know, standing up in all hands meetings, giving stand-up comedy routines. What he was doing was finding those, what he called hidden gems in his organization, elevating them and letting the levity come more naturally. So one example is, he had this all hands meeting and he had heard that there was a young designer on his team who sang opera. And, she sang in a gospel choir. That's what it was. And no one knew this because she was pretty quiet. She was very junior. And Hiroki saw this as an opportunity to elevate her and create a moment of joy in the organization. So at the next all hands meeting, he created this, this secret special event where he was up on stage in front of 2,000 people. And he said, you know, I want to invite one of our team members to come up because I want her to share what she's been working on. So, you know, this woman, she comes to the front of the room, and as soon as she grabs the mic, the curtains behind him part, and there is a gospel choir behind her. And she starts singing this gospel song. And then all of a sudden it's a flash mob where people are coming, you know, forward from the crowd, and everyone's just laughing and, you know, dancing. And it's this moment of joy, right? This is not joke writing. This is not humor. It really is creating these moments of joy. And having more of those moments is what we should look to strive for, not necessarily gospel choirs, but joy over jokes.
And that distinction is really important, actually, because I think there will be people listening who start to get a bit nervous when they hear that they have to be funny, because they think, well, you know, I'm not a funny person. But you're making the point in the book that, A, it's not about, you know, joke, boom, boom, aren't I hilarious, but also that you can learn techniques to use, and it's not necessarily always about an innate ability to be funny. It's actually something that can be taught and you can get better at.
Yeah. So we're now going into sort of the realm of comedy techniques, and we teach these not so that people can be comedians, but really just so that something that feels like a really nebulous art form is broken down into something that feels more accessible. So in one of the chapters of our book, we dive deep into techniques from comedians. And what we find is that a couple things. One, people think that humor or that comedy involves inventing something from thin air. And the reality is it's more often just being observant about what's going on in our world and speaking truth to whatever you authentically feel or whatever you authentically believe. So that's, you know, number one is the exercise we have our students do is just write down anything from your life that you think is remotely interesting or a little bit odd or maybe even humorous, but don't even put the bar there, you know, just interesting or odd. So once people have those, then it's about crafting your words in a way that creates humor. And so those two principles are humor, at the heart of humor is truth and misdirection. So when we mine our lives for those truths, we're hitting on truth. misdirection is all about how we communicate our humor to the world. So what I see most often when people fail in humor is it's not for lack of a great idea. It's because they don't have the structure right. And they give, you know, they give away a punchline too early. So some of these techniques like creating misdirection, rule of three, creating contrast, using specifics are all aimed at demystifying this art and understanding how creating humor is actually, there's science to it. There's sort of math to it as well.
Yeah. And I love that chapter actually, where you kind of dissect what works and you suddenly start to see, because comedians that you know and love kind of jump into your head and you're like, that's why it works. That's why it's so funny. And you know, clearly some people have a real gift, but ultimately not all of it is rocket science. And right. Like you say, you can kind of try things and find results out of it. What I loved as well, though, is the fact that in all of this, we come back again and again to the point that this is serious. Humor is serious. And your course that you were saying you teach at Stanford to the MBAs has the same amount of credit for them as managerial accounting and financial trading strategies. That just made me laugh out loud, because people would think, oh, this must be a fun course that people just do because their heads can't take any more of the serious stuff. But actually, the point is, this is a serious course that is opening up minds and perception to a whole other way of working.
It really is. And when used the right way, it transforms not just the way we work, but the way we live, the way we interact with our families, with our kids, with our partners, with our parents. You know, we spend the majority of our waking hours doing professional work for many people. Many people spend the majority of their waking hours doing professional work. And so the way that we interact with our colleagues, we're training our brains that this is the way we should think. This is the way we should behave. This is the way we should act. And so when we hold things so tightly at work, when we are taking ourselves so seriously and our missions so seriously without having the outlet of laughter and humor, then we bring that home as well. And all of a sudden, and we find this in the data, all of a sudden we're not laughing as much at home. And we're not laughing as much with our partner, and we're having a harder time finding joy.
There's a brilliant picture you paint of a meeting that happened between Madeleine Albright, Secretary of State, former Secretary of State, of course, and her Russian counterpart, Yevgeny Primakov. And this was a high stakes meeting. You know, there was conflict, there was tension, and yet it ends with them singing West Side Story. And I almost couldn't believe that was true. And yet there was something that struck me as almost magical about it.
It truly was. And there was a point at the in the story where our jaws were basically on the table and Secretary Albright looked at us and she said, there are things you could never imagine a Secretary of State is asked to do. So yeah, it was this moment where it was the ASEAN forum. And so a whole bunch of countries were coming together. And at the end of the forum, it's traditional that they do a skit night or a skit, you know, every country performs skits at the dinner, which is totally mind-blowing, by the way, but people take this extremely seriously. And so the Americans came with this, as Secretary Albright would say, really sad excuse for a skit involving Mary Had a Little Lamb. And she told us the Russians also had a pretty sorry excuse for a skit. And so they decided to team up. And as you mentioned, her counterpart in who was representing Russia at this meeting, they had had a pretty rocky start, the two of them. So in their first ever meeting, Secretary Albright came to the meeting and he looked at her and he said, you do know what my previous job was, right? And he was a senior official in the KGB. And she said, yes. And he said, well, then you know that I know everything about you. And so that, you know, it's a tense way to start a meeting. Fast forward to the ASEAN forum, and they decide to do this skit together. And Secretary Albright just leaned into this as an opportunity to create some joy, to create some levity. They ended up staying up late, you know, drinking vodka and planning out this skit. And the next day, the two of them are singing a duet called East-West Story to the tune of West Side Story. You know, and what Secretary Albright says is that it fundamentally shifted their relationship. She was no longer Secretary of State Albright. You know, she was Madeline then, and she became a person. They created a personal relationship, and it transformed the way that they were able to negotiate and get really serious things done.
That shift was what I found really interesting, and also I think what people can take away as something that could be useful to them, because you make the point as well that if you're in a negotiation with someone, say you're, you know, trying to work out what you think your salary should be, and you've got to go in and talk to your boss, or you're trying to kind of nail down a deal, that humor can shift the whole dynamic of that kind of conversation done well.
It can. And this again comes back to the neuroscience, that when we are able to use humor effectively in the workplace, when we make other people laugh, then again, these hormones fire in our brains and we change our perceptions of the person who is creating the laughter. And what we've found in research studies is that if you are able to use humor effectively in a presentation or a testimonial, people will view you as 37% higher in status, as more competent at your job, and also more confident. And so we see this translating to, as you said, around the negotiations table, where we find people are not only willing to pay a higher price if you use a little bit of humor, but they'll walk away from the table feeling better about you, feeling better about the negotiation, and feeling less stressed.
I thought that was so useful. I'm going to bank that one for my next hardcore conversation with my boss. But the other word that struck me through all of this was, and you've used it a couple of times, was about authenticity. And what was quite powerful was when you, quite early on in the book, mention a realization you had yourself about the fact that you, and a lot of us, live a life where you don't bring your whole self to work because you're expected to be serious. So on the one hand, you are this great lecturer and analyst and media coach and so on. And yet this whole other side of you as a stand-up comic didn't always come with you into the workplace. And that was quite a strong realization for you at one point. You thought, hang on, something's not quite sitting right here.
Yeah, I got to a point where I really felt like I was leading a double life, where at work, I was serious and professional and austere, you know, very well respected, really kicking butt at my job, you know, doing very, very well. And then on nights and weekends, I had a completely different personality. I was performing improv comedy. I was, you know, having a lot of fun and being pretty goofy with my friends. And there was no intersection there. And what I found was that I was burning out. You know, I was not making meaningful friendships with my colleagues. I didn't really have any friends at work. You know, I had colleagues and I got along with them, but no one really knew me, which is a really sad, it's sad to think about it now, but that's where I was. And for me, I thought that that was a necessary evil of being successful as a young woman in the workplace. And part of my mission that I really deeply believe in is debunking that myth, especially for young women, but really for all young people at work, because our senses of humor, whatever we're doing before age 23, before we fall off that humor cliff, that is a superpower for us. And so we don't have to change ourselves. In fact, the most powerful thing we can do is not let go of that magic that we had. You know, there's this beautiful Robin Williams quote, you only get one little spark of madness, you mustn't lose it.
A lot of what you've said there really resonates, I think, with the period that we're in at the moment, with COVID affecting so many people and workplaces, that everybody's kind of on screens looking at each other, the workplace camaraderie maybe has gone. And I'm imagining you've been reflecting on a lot of that and how humor can take us through some of this and keep those bonds and those relationships, even though a lot of our work has become virtual.
Yeah, I mean, it has been breathtaking to see the data suggesting just how much mental well-being has been on the decline since this shift to remote work. And we know that 76% of people say that they find it really hard to connect meaningfully with our colleagues, which makes total sense. We know that mental well-being is on the decline for all of us, but especially for older groups. And we also know that social connection is the number one factor that lifts people. And so, you know, in this moment in history, I think humor is not just playing a role of helping us uncover and process hard realities, which of course it is doing that. Thank you, John Oliver and others who are using humor in that way. But it's also this incredible superpower for social connection. So again, to lean on some of the research here, we know that couples who are asked to reminisce about moments of shared laughter versus moments that were where they were just happy together later report feeling 23% more satisfied in their relationships. And this is just from telling stories of moments of shared laughter. So, you know, laughter, as we know from earlier, it quickens the path to social connection. And in a moment when we have never been more physically distanced from those we love, humor cuts the emotional distance.
Dare I ask you for a couple of sort of tips or pointers for people who need to try and inject a bit of humor into their endless turgid Zoom calls or their communications? There was some great stuff that really made me chuckle in the book about how you can use your kind of out of office sign off email and the way you communicate in a written format as well as verbally.
Yeah, I have. All right. So I have a couple mindset recommendations and then some really tactical ones. I'll start tactical. Tactically, we rely so much on our written communications now, and we are writing like robots. And it makes sense because we're sitting in front of computers. Everything that is signaling us, everything that's signaling our brains says, you are talking to a robot, be like a robot. You are interacting with a robot, be like a robot. And so if you read back your emails, we have our students do a humor audit where they look at their last 10 emails and they pick out as many jargon words as they can, or as many phrases that look like they could have been written by robots versus humans. And so what we do is, step one is just talk like a human. If you read your email out loud and you wouldn't say, you know, attached, pleased, find the meeting notes, if you wouldn't say that, then don't say it in an email, just talk like a human. The second thing is to make callbacks to moments of shared laughter. So a callback is where you simply make reference to a moment that people that you've shared earlier that is fun or lighthearted. So you can do this really effectively in your sign off of an email. So instead of saying, you know, maybe you were talking about how your house smells like Lysol on a meeting, right? So in your follow up email, instead of signing off with best or kind regards, you can say, you know, with levity and Lysol, or something like that, just that just references a moment of levity from earlier. A third thing is to include a PS. This seems totally outdated and a little bit odd. We never have PSs, but we also know that people often read the PS before they read the body of the email. There's something so enticing and sort of secret about a PS. And so so if you include a little bit of lightheartedness there, you know, it's also free reign. No one expects there to be real content in the PS. So you sort of include some lighthearted, either it's a callback or it's something sort of personal in the PS, or an article that you've read recently that's lighthearted that you think someone would enjoy. Then that's a third, you know, really tactical thing that people can do.
Fantastic. And mindset, we all need to kind of shift the way we're even thinking in order to make this all work.
Yeah, mindset. I have a really simple exercise, which is at the end of every day for the next 7 days, write down the three funniest things that happened that day and how you felt during them. And this seems like a really simple exercise, but it leans on a principle in psychology called the priming effect, which essentially has found that our brains are more likely to find the things that we set out to look for. So there have been research studies where you have an array of random words on a screen. And we know that if someone sees the word doctor, and then on the next screen, there are 50 different words, but one of them is nurse, our brains are more likely to find that word nurse, and we're more likely to find it more quickly. And so it's something that cognitively we don't even realize is happening. But when we are thinking about humor more actively, when we're on the lookout for moments of laughter and moments of joy, then our brains find those moments in such a powerful way. So I would say on day one, this exercise might feel hard to do. By day seven, it will feel so much easier, and your lists, you won't be able to keep it to just three. So that's my really tactical recommendation that actually has a profound impact on our mindset and psychology.
Fantastic. Naomi Bagdonis, you have, I believe, fully equipped us now to put on our metaphorical capes and exercise our new humor superpowers. Thank you so much for sharing your OMI with us today. And if you'd like to buy a copy of Humor, Seriously, Why Humor is a Superpower at Life and in Work, it's out now, and you can simply click on the link in our podcast description. Don't forget, we're all about variety here at Bokomi. We have podcasts that will make you laugh, think, rage, maybe even cry. But what they have in common is they bring fascinating insights from some of the most wanted minds in the worlds of tech, business, science, and culture. So all you need to do is subscribe to Bokomi on your chosen audio platform. Do leave us a review, and why not also head to our website, bokomi.com, and you can sign up there for our most wanted email. That way you'll always know about upcoming guests. I'm Rachel Schofield. Lovely to have you with us today. And remember, keep smiling. I love Bokomi.